Okay, let's trace a little bit of the geography of where David is at. If we look up on the map, you can see most of what occurs here is happening in the southern regions of Israel. We don't deal much at all with up north here around Galilee, or even the area that in the New Testament times is known as Samaria. Because Saul has located his kingdom here in Gibeah, which is just about at the tip of the Dead Sea as far as north and south goes. So we're going to zoom in on there just a little bit so we can see some of these. Right here is Gibeah. That's where Saul has made his capital of his kingdom. It's where the royal palace is at, where his government is administered from. It's from there that David fled south to Nob. Again, just a couple of mile journey. So he fled south to Nob, consulted the priests, and then made his way over to Gath, some 20 miles over to the west in the land of the Philistines. From there, it says he went to Adullam, probably right around here, where he hid in caves for a little while until he heard of the plight of the people of the city of Keilah, which is right here on the border between Israel, Judah, and the Philistines. You can, I don't know how clear it is up here on the screen, but you can sort of see how rough this mountainous region is over here and how it starts to smooth off over here towards the Mediterranean Sea. The coastal area is much flatter, much better farmland, and that's where the Philistines lived. And so the Philistines had come up to ransack Keilah and steal any grain that they happened to grow because it was the harvest season. And that's when David took his men, went down and helped the people of Keilah, fought off the Philistine raiders. He stayed in Keilah for a little bit until Saul heard where he was. So Saul amassed the army and marched down from Gibeah to Keilah. But before he got there, David inquired of the Lord whether or not he should stay in Keilah, or whether or not the people of Keilah would surrender him to Saul. That answer was affirmative. The Lord told David, the people will surrender you. And so David fled. And we have in verse 14 of chapter 23 a summary statement about the next several years of David's life. David's in his mid-20s right about now. We don't know how long exactly he has been fleeing from Saul, but somewhere within the 1 to 2 year range is probably adequate to explain everything that's happened, maybe even 3 years. But if he started serving Saul right on about 20 years old, and he comes to the kingship of Judah when he's 30 years old, we are somewhere in his mid to late 20s. So he's 26, 27 years old. He served with Saul for several years, was married before he had to flee from him. And so that gives us a little bit of an idea of the timeline. But this summary statement in verse 14, David remained in the strongholds in the wilderness, in the hill country of the wilderness of Ziph. And Saul sought him every day, but God did not give him into his hand. So this is a statement of what's going on for the next time period as David is hiding from Saul. It says he's doing so down here in this area of Ziph. You can see this is quite a bit farther south of Keilah. Of course, he couldn't stay in Keilah because the people there had shown him that they were not going to help David at all. So he fled south to Ziph. Okay. Ziph is getting down here in this very mountainous region, and you're getting into much more of a desert situation than you are up north around Bethlehem and Keilah. Probably even in David's day, though we know he had a lot more trees in his day than there are there now, even in David's day, this area is described as a wilderness, a wasteland. There's not many people living there, and there's not much that grows or lives there. But that's where David has decided to hide, is here around Ziph. And that's where we pick him up in verse 15. David saw that Saul had come out to seek his life. David was in the wilderness of Ziph at Horesh. So this starts to be a repeated theme in David's life, that he goes and hides somewhere for a little while, Saul finds out where he is, and then comes out against him. And again, that is explained in verse 14, that Saul sought him every day. This was a consuming obsession with Saul to figure out where David was hiding, and to try and track him down. So how much of his energy went into trying to hunt down David rather than administering the kingdom the way he was supposed to? So as soon as Saul finds out where David is, he starts to hunt him down again. And remember, as soon as Saul heard that David had fled Keilah, Saul turned the armies around and marched back home. Now, Saul has heard that David is in the area of Ziph. I always thought some of these Old Testament names really sound like Dr. Seuss titles, don't they? The Land of Ziph. It kind of sounds like a Dr. Seuss book to me. But these are real places. They've excavated many of these. And it says that David was in the wilderness of Ziph at Horesh. Okay? Horesh is the Hebrew word for a forest or a thicket, something where there's a lot of tree-ish kind of growth. And so south of Ziph, there would have been a forested area that David was hiding in. Of course, that doesn't exist today. All those forests are gone. So many reasons why this land has been desolated, because there's been, since David's time, about 3,000 years of war. And any time invading armies come in, they tend to cut down the trees to keep the local population from being able to support themselves. That's how you win wars, wars of attrition. Keep them from being able to supply themselves. But there was also a period when the people in control of Palestine levied a tax based on how many trees you had growing. And so the more trees you had growing in your property, the more you owed in taxes. And so guess how you avoid paying taxes in that scenario? Down go the trees. And so many trees have been wiped out in this land because of war, because of governmental policy, because of all around the lack of blessing because God's people are not fulfilling the terms of the covenant. And so the land is a lot more desolate than it is now. But even then, the fact that they can label this one section as a forest tells us there's not a whole lot beyond that forest. Maybe it's all grassland or plainland or something, but David's hiding in a particular area just south of Ziph that's called the forest or Horesh. But something encouraging happens here. Verse 16, Jonathan, Saul's son, rose and went to David at Horesh. I mean, imagine what a risk Jonathan's taking here. To risk his life by heading down there to see David, whom he knows his father's trying to kill. But it shows us that Jonathan really has got a much clearer perception of what God is doing than his dad does. Because Jonathan goes down, and look what he says to David. This is what really amazes me. He said to him, "Do not fear, for the hand of Saul my father shall not find you." Well, how could you say that with any certitude, Jonathan? Well, what does Jonathan know that Saul doesn't know? Or maybe Saul does know, but he just doesn't want to admit. And that's what he says next. "You shall be king of Israel, and I shall be next to you. And Saul, my father, also knows this." So Jonathan comes down to David, and despite all of David's wanderings, despite his hiding in caves in the wilderness and all the difficult circumstances that he's enduring here, Jonathan is trying to encourage his friend. And remember that Jonathan and David are not the same age. Jonathan's probably 30-plus years older than David. And not only that, but Jonathan is the crown prince of Israel. If Saul were to stay on the throne, Jonathan would be the next king when Saul passed away. Because that's how monarchies work. The first oldest son becomes king in place of his father. You don't elect new ones every generation. It's inherited. And so Jonathan, who is the crown prince of Israel, the next in line for the kingship, he comes down and he's telling David, a man that's 30 years younger than him, and a man that was a servant in his house, and he says, "You're going to be the next king." Jonathan can recognize that it's not on him. That office has not been given to him. It's been given to David. And he says, "My father knows this." It's one of the reasons Saul is pursuing David with such ferocity, because of Saul's jealousy of David. Now, Saul probably is putting this all together because, number one, Samuel told him he was not going to continue in the kingship. But number two, ever since David has arrived on the scene, Saul has been diminishing in his influence and power, and David's been growing in it. Because we read that little commentary by the writer of this book that the Spirit of the Lord departed from Saul. But one verse before that, it says, now the Spirit of the Lord fell upon David from that day forward. So we see God energizing David to accomplish kingly tasks all throughout even his young career. When he's just a commander in the military, he's the one going out before the people and rescuing them from the Philistines, not Saul. He's the one delivering Israel from the hand of her enemies, not Saul. And so this whole time, from the moment Saul departed into his disobedience by not destroying Amalek, Saul has been decreasing. David's been increasing. And Jonathan says, my father recognizes this, even if he won't admit it. He sees it. He knows it. That's what's driving him crazy. He knows that you are going to be the next king of Israel. So we see Jonathan exhibiting such a strong faith in what God is doing. We saw it in him when he attacked the Philistine garrison. Remember, he and his shield bearer went over, and his response was, hey, God can save by many or by few. It doesn't matter. So Jonathan has constantly and consistently displayed to us that he's a man of great faith. And he's even willing to step back and relinquish something that we would humanly say is rightfully his in order to see God's plans accomplished. He's willing to step back and let David step forward, a man that's much younger than him, a man that doesn't have the social prestige as him, but he's willing to say, God's Spirit's resting on you. You're the ones God has chosen. Now get out there and do it. I'm going to back you up. Well, how many of us need a friend like that? It's willing to say, just cling to what God has told you. Now, we don't know if Jonathan knew about Samuel's anointing of David. It's never mentioned again. And so we don't know who David told, who David didn't tell. But whatever the reason that Jonathan knows that David is going to be the next king, he's certain of it. And he's certain that because God has promised that David's going to be king, that has to mean that Saul will not be successful in his pursuits. It has to mean that David's going to somehow escape all of these close encounters. Which I forgot to mention, by the way, is the title of our sermon tonight, Rejections and Close Encounters. Okay. We'll get to the rejections here in just a minute, but I'm amazed at what God does here. David has fled from Keilah. He's been rejected by the people there, but God's not going to leave him without some sort of support. And so he sends Jonathan to give him this encouragement and say, you're going to be king. We've got to look for these kind of friends. We've got to look for these kind of people to draw close to us. And more importantly than that, we've got to try to be these kind of people for the friends that are near us, to constantly be encouraging them and reminding them of God's promises and say, keep your eyes on this. This is what's true. This is your foundation. Don't sway from it. To be that kind of friend that'll just keep encouraging somebody when they're in the midst of a trial. So Jonathan went to David at Horesh and strengthened his hand in God. And the two of them made a covenant, verse 18, before the Lord. I already covered verse 17. That's why I'm jumping there. The two of them made a covenant before the Lord. David remained at Horesh, and Jonathan went home. So they renew their covenant that they've already made several times. That covenant of protection, that covenant of friendship, that covenant whereby Jonathan promises to relinquish his right, his claim to the throne, and give it to David. And David promises not to exact retribution upon Jonathan's family, as would be the custom if David would come to the throne. Very often, any other claimants to the throne would be executed or expelled from the country. But David has promised not to do that in Jonathan's case. None of Jonathan's family is going to come to harm by David's hand. So they renew this covenant again after Jonathan reaffirms his commitment to seeing David put on the throne. And so that's the encouragement that David receives, but God sent him that encouragement because God also knew that he was going to lead David through another rejection. And that's verse 19. The Ziphites went up to Saul at Gibeah, saying, is not David hiding among us in the strongholds at Horesh on the hill of Hachilah? There you go, Dan. That's another one. If you see that CH, you got to get the ch sound in there. At Hachilah, which is south of Jeshimon. That word Jeshimon is the Hebrew word for wilderness or wasteland. So the picture that we're giving us is here's the town of Ziph, and south of Ziph is Jeshimon, which is this wasteland, and just a little bit south of that would be the forests, Horish, the forest land. So there would have been an intervening space. We know that the town of Ziph sits upon a hill. We've excavated it. We know where it's at. And it commands a great view of all the area around it. So if you are in the town of Ziph, you can see for miles and miles and miles all around, which is probably why the inhabitants of Ziph knew right where David was at, as they could see him. They could see his men moving about the mountains and going in and out of the forest land that's there. But the picture they give us is there's Ziph. South of that is the Jeshimon. Well, stumble over that one, huh? Jeshimon, the wasteland, and then just on the other side of the wasteland is this forest, Horish. Okay? And so that's a little bit of the topography for us. So they go all the way up to Gibeah, which was probably a 2 to 3 day hike. It's about 25 miles. That's 25 miles as the crow flies. So when you're going up and down the steep valleys of southern Judah, it takes quite a bit longer to make the trek. So they travel all the way back north here, and we'll scroll north so we can see where we're at, to Gibeah, where Saul has his government centered, and they report to him and say, hey, David's down with us. We've seen him coming in and going out. You got to come down and get him. We'll help you. When you get there, look at verse 20. Now, O king, come down according to all your heart's desire to come down. I'm willing to sacrifice your feet, marching back and forth across the Judean hills in order to locate my enemy. And then I'll search him out. And guess how I'm going to search him out? I'm going to use you. I'm going to make you do all the hard work. So you go find out. Tell me exactly where he is. Get some reconnaissance for me. And then we'll go down and get him. And they listened to this. Verse 24, they arose and went to Ziph ahead of Saul. So the picture we get is that they come back to Ziph. Saul is remaining in Gibeah until he hears further word about where David is hiding exactly. So they come all the way back down here to Ziph, and they're going to try to find David. Now, David and his men were in the wilderness of Maon in the Arabah to the south of Jeshimon. So Maon is a town right here. This is a very tall mountain down in that area. It's very conical shaped, which is going to be important here just a little bit later. A lot of the mountains down there are, you know, long kind of mountains. It's very hard to get around them. But this one is a cone shape. So there's a very circular pattern to its base, which is going to be important here in a minute. But on the top of it, we have excavated some walls, some ancient walls of a fortress. Whether it was there when David was there, we're not sure of, but apparently it's an extremely defensible position for David. Of course, if you're at the top and you're on rocks, which it says are there, then you have a very good view of the people coming up at you. And so if anybody tries to invade, you have the advantage being up on top of this height. And that's where David has settled himself, just south of Jeshimon, south of the forest, or south of the wastelands. So that's where he's at. It's a defensible position, but it's also somewhat locked in. And so Saul hears of it. And now that he knows exactly where David is, he's ready to come out. Verse 25, Saul and his men went to seek him. Now, we don't have a statement here that Saul mustered the army like he did before. It just says Saul and his men. Probably this is the standing army. Saul did have a small force, an honor guard, if you will, that was constantly on call. It was a couple of thousand men who were good warriors, and so that's probably who's coming down now. He's not going to risk drafting the entire Israeli army at this point like he did last time, because last time he was pretty embarrassed by it. So he gets his men, and they went to seek David, and David was told. So he went down to the rock and lived in the wilderness of Maon. And when Saul heard that, he pursued after David in the wilderness of Maon. So here's David constantly moving, trying to stay one step ahead of Saul as Saul comes out to find him. And this is where we get into this amazing scene showing God's protection of David. Because look at what happens here in verse 26. Saul is coming down from the south. He would have probably passed through Hebron and Ziph. He finds out David's had been in the forest south of Ziph. So he goes to the forest. David's not there. He's moved a little farther south to Maon. But Saul hears that that's where David's at. So Saul starts marching down to Moen. David's going to try to get out. So David leaves on one side of the mountain. Verse 26, Saul went on one side of the mountain, and David and his men on the other side. This is close. This is where we get into the close encounters that we mentioned. He's been rejected again by the people of Ziph, despite the fact that David is a preserving and protecting influence everywhere he goes. These towns of Israel continue to side with Saul. They reject David, and they keep telling on David and telling where he's hiding to Saul. So Saul comes down, and now David's got this close encounter, not of the third kind, just close encounters. David's on one side of the mountain. Saul's on the other side. This is about as close as Saul has been to David in several years. You're probably talking not more than a mile away from each other are these two forces. Probably David's outnumbered strongly because Saul had a couple of thousand men at his immediate command. David has how many? About 600 now. He grew a couple hundred when he was at Keilah. So he's got about 600 men. And he's marching around one side of the mountain while Saul's marching around the other side. And you'd say, well, this could get monotonous real fast if they just keep staying on opposite sides of the mountain. But that's not what's happening, because look what's going on in the middle of verse 26. David was hurrying to get away from Saul. So we get the picture here that Saul is catching up. Saul's closing this trap around David. Maybe David's trying to exit on the south side of the mountain from the back doors, and Saul's got his men pouring around the sides, and they're getting ready to close David in and capture him. Whatever the tactics there, things are not looking good for David. It looks like he's about to be caught despite Jonathan's encouragement, and this has got to be a stressful time for him. David was hurrying to get away from Saul. But here is where we see God stepping in again to protect his man. Because look at what happens here. How often does God do the unexpected? All the time. How often has God led you right to the brink of disaster and then stepped in a mighty way that you say, I never would have thought of that happening? Well, that's what's happening here. David doesn't even outrun his opponent. He's not about to engage in a battle against his king, but look at what he does here. He's running, trying to get away, and as Saul and his men were closing in on David and his men to capture them, a messenger came to Saul saying, hurry and come, for the Philistines have made a raid against the land. We're not told where. We're not told how many. But here, Saul has just received this message that his country's in trouble, and now he's got a decision to make. Am I going to let my obsession with David override my responsibility to protect my people? The Philistines are invading. This was not an uncommon occurrence. David just fought off an invasion of the Philistines, albeit a small one, over at Keilah. But now Saul hears about it, and it is his responsibility as the king to protect his people. And here's how God works, sometimes in unexpected ways. David's just about to be caught. Looks like everything's all over, and yet God steps in with one simple messenger. How true is the proverb that the king's heart are like rivers of water in the hands of the Lord. He steers them wherever he wants. And so when Saul hears about this invasion, verse 28, Saul returned from pursuing after David and went against the Philistines. Therefore, that place was called the Rock of Escape. Literal Hebrew wording there is the Rock of Smoothness. Because it's a place where David was able to slide out of the noose. He was able to slip out of trouble. It was a smooth rock, a place you could easily slip from because he slipped out of Saul's trap. But there's God protecting his man from one danger after another, so that Jonathan's faith in what God had told David is proved to be true. You will not be caught by my father. He's not going to lay his hands on you. So even when things look bleak, when it looks like you're about to be captured, don't worry about it. It's not going to happen. Verse 29, David went up from there and lived in the strongholds of En-Gedi. So you can see on our map here, Moen is in the central region of Judah, but as you head towards the east, you start descending into the Dead Sea Valley. Okay. If you can see that this section right here starts to get a lot lighter colored, that's because you're going down. Okay, the mountains get much steeper. The crags and the valleys get much deeper. So this is a land of deep ravines, of sheer cliffs, of tall mountains. It's a treacherous land, but it's a perfect hiding place. Because saturating all the hills over here in this wilderness of En-Gedi, we've got it labeled En-Gedi right here on the edge, but that word En-Gedi really encompasses all this land over here. Saturating these hills are thousands upon thousands of caves. You might know some of these caves by another name, which was farther north up here, called Qumran, which, middle of last century, they found snuggled in some of these thousands of caves some pottery filled with ancient copies of the Old Testament. The Dead Sea Scrolls were found in these caves. So David takes up his hiding place over here in En-Gedi. There's also another famous formation down here in the southern part of En-Gedi called Masada. Anybody heard of Masada? Okay. That is an ancient fortress. It's been there a very long time. And when the Romans invaded Israel in 70 AD, well, they actually invaded in 66, took them 4 years to get down this far south, destroying town after town after town after town, the last Jews took up their last stance in Masada, which is down here in this region of En-Gedi. It's a fortress built on top of a mountain, and the only way the Romans could get there was to build a long, several-mile-long ramp. They just kept mounding up dirt until they built a ramp all the way up to the top of the mountain. And that's how Masada was finally conquered. But, of course, it was only conquered, too, because all the Jews there decided to commit suicide before the Romans could get in. But it's a fortress that's been there much, much longer than when the Romans were there. And some estimates say that it may have been around in David's time, and that perhaps David was using this area, Masada, as one of his strongholds, because it mentions specifically he was in the strongholds of En-Gedi. But it's a land that's easy to hide in, if not a land that makes for comfort. It's not an easy land to live in, because there's not a whole lot there. But God has shown time and time again in David's life that he's going to be faithful to his promise to protect David. And that simple promise, "You will be king of Israel," means that if I'm not the king of Israel right now, and God has promised me that I will be king of Israel, then nothing between now and then is going to stop that from happening. So even though I'm running from Saul, I don't know how this is all going to work out, but somehow it is. Either Saul's not going to catch me, or he's going to catch me and he's not going to hurt me, or he's going to finally surrender and turn over the kingdom to me. But somehow, God's promise is going to come true. Now, we don't have the promise for us that we're going to be the king of Israel. Oh, we're going to be kings. We're going to be priests. We're going to rule with Christ in his kingdom. He's given us those promises. We're going to stand before him alive. So what could happen between now and then that could thwart that plan and make that promise void? You know, if you write a check to somebody, you're making a promise to pay them money. So if I write a check to Arlene and say, "I'm going to give you $5,000, here you go, here's this check." All I have to do is grab that thing out of her hand and write a four-letter word on it, right? Not that kind of four-letter word. All I got to write on is V-O-I-D, void. And suddenly that promise is no longer good to her. She can't take that check to the bank and cash it. Because the bank would look at her and say, "Sorry, this has been voided. This promise has been negated." Nothing can void God's promise to you. Everything that happens to you is good. Not comfortable, not easy, but it's good. So everything that's happening to David is good. And it's going to wind up in him being the king of Israel. God is using this time in David's life to prepare him and to teach him to trust. Because we don't learn to trust when we can see the answers, do we? The only time we learn to trust is when everything in front of us is pitch black. And you say, "Well, God, you're telling me to take one more step, but I'm not even sure there's a floor there." But he says, "Step forward." You say, "Okay, I'm going to trust you. One step. That's all he tells you. And it's still pitch black in front of you. You can't see the floor. You can't see ahead of you. You can't see any of the results of the decisions you're making. All you can hear is God saying, take one more step. You say, there might be a Lego on the floor, Lord. But he says, take one more step. You say, okay, I'll take one more. And David is moving one step at a time from one stronghold to the next. Just one step ahead of Saul. And in this case, not very many steps ahead of Saul. He's just on the other side of the mountain. But God is leading him from one place to the next, teaching David to trust him. Because when David becomes king, that's the most important lesson he's going to need. It's how to trust and obey. Let's pray.